This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today, we're rebroadcasting two interviews from earlier this year. Coming up, Upjohn Institute economist Kevin Hollenbeck discusses a report on proposals to improve education in Michigan. But first, in June, Sevilla Mann told us about the 1950s-era proposal to transform downtown Kalamazoo.
In the 1950s, city leaders embraced a plan to transform downtown Kalamazoo. It was intended to preserve the city center as suburban growth boomed. Well-known architect Victor Gruen proposed to turn the downtown into a series of pedestrian malls, surrounded by a ring road. Clearly, that didn't happen, though a few pieces did get built, notably Crosstown Parkway and the Kalamazoo Mall. We speak with historian and Kalamazoo Valley Museum curator emeritus Tom Dietz about how the Gruen plan would have changed Kalamazoo. Tom Dietz, welcome to West Southwest.
Well, thank you. Glad to be on the show.
I didn't realize that saving the downtown and that downtown revitalization was a concern as early as the 1950s.
Oh, it would have been, because I think that it was clear to anybody who was foresighted at the time that there was any number of factors in the 12, 15 years after World War II that was pushing suburban development, from the construction of the interstate highway system, which by 1958, 59 was being built where it is today, right here in Kalamazoo, but it had been happening across the country. Malls were springing up. Federal government programs to promote housing in the 1940s, late 40s and early 50s under first the so-called GI Bill of Rights and then under other programs that come up from the Federal Housing Administration. They will insure your mortgages, but they placed a premium that it easier if those mortgages were on single-family homes. And cities didn't have the land for the development of single-family housing. Most of it had been built up. Kalamazoo was typical. So I think city fathers recognized it, and they recognized that there was competition coming in terms of housing, in terms of transportation, in terms of shopping. Yet the heart of the city was commercial. How do we maintain that? We had Penny's downtown. We had Sears downtown. We had J.T. Grant. We had Woolworths. We had on and on. How do we keep them here?
The Kalamazoo Valley Museum has the model that was built of this plan, and we had the benefit of looking at it. And it looks different enough that even if you're familiar with the layout of downtown Kalamazoo, it takes a minute to get oriented. I think looking at it, it did for me anyway. What I noticed was that you've got a lot of parking around the edges, and then you've got many pedestrian malls in the center. And so this wasn't just a sort of cosmetic change to a few blocks. This would have been a really big change for downtown.
Oh, it would have dramatically reshaped the downtown area. People know about the Burdick Mall, portions of which the North Burdick Mall, the latter part of it from north from Michigan Avenue to just up to Eleanor Street, still exists, but which had originally been from Michigan Avenue south for several blocks, one of the famous because it's one of the first, if not the first, urban pedestrian mall in the city. But the Gruen plan proposed not only that Burdick Street be turned into a pedestrian mall, but large portions of Michigan Avenue between Rose Street over to about Edwards, as well as portions of Portage. The whole downtown would have become a pedestrian mall, not just those two blocks. That plan, of course, is never fully implemented. There are a whole host of reasons from politics and money and others, how to finance it, that is, when I say money. But yes, if you would not have recognized downtown and what we have today in this really revitalized downtown would have been entirely different.
It seems like you have this idea that people are going to drive to the downtown area and then they're going to walk around it.
The ring road would have been so extensive that what was proposed is you would park pretty much along the exterior. There would still be residential. You could still get to within a few blocks of this primary pedestrian area. But there would also have been a lot of sort of public transit. People might be familiar if you come downtown Kalamazoo during the holidays and see the Holly Jolly Trolley, which has a route. You would have had public transportation like that, buses that would have been coming frequently, not just on the hour, but frequently you could have hopped on and they would have taken you to that portion. Then you would have hopped off where you wanted to go.
And so the idea was that you wouldn't have to face traffic congestion in a downtown. Instead, you could drive without hitting traffic, park, take one of these trolleys or modes of transportation in, and then enjoy walking around.
Yes, it was sort of like creating the mall, the shopping mall experience in downtown. the Southland Mall, which first opened, was really a strip mall. Kalamazoo doesn't get really an enclosed mall up for some time until the Crossroads Mall opens. But it was clear from other cities that, like Detroit, where Northland was enormously popular by this time, of course, today Northland is on the auction block, but city fathers could see that. And they assumed that what, and the planner, Mr. Gruen, Victor Gruen, is that pedestrians like the idea of being able to walk from store to store without having to look first left, then right to cross the street. And since in a shopping center, you parked and then walked in and then you walked around from store to store, they were attempting really to create that while, for the most part, retaining the older buildings and the older stores that were downtown.
It's interesting to me to think that at the time when the Gruen plan came along, when there was this concern about suburbanization, that there was probably even then a lot less sprawl than there is now. I'm guessing you didn't have, you know, strip malls all the way down West Nudge, for example.
Oh, no. I mean, that's just starting. I mean, the Gruen plan is an effort to retain a vital downtown. It's not to, oh, downtown is decaying. What are we going to renew? How are we going to renew it? How are we going to restore it? How are we going to revive it? It's, we've got a downtown. It is still very lively. We've got a wide selection of retail outlets here. How do we keep this as a lively downtown so that, you know, as these new retail centers pop up and housing pops up? And for that matter, we should keep in mind in Kalamazoo, this is the period when our, at that time, one of our largest, well, two of our largest manufacturing concerns are either in decline, the paper industry, which is declining, and then the Upjohn Company is moving out of the city and is moving its production facilities from the downtown area out to where the Pfizer plant is today, down at Bishop Road and Romance off of Portage. So there's all of these forces pulling away from downtown, and I think you have to give the city fathers at the time, unfortunately there weren't many women involved, you know, politically, and so I'm not trying to be sexist by saying the city fathers, it's just that that was the era. There are one or two women who play roles, but it's primarily the men. But in any case, it's, they are trying to be looking ahead. They're trying to anticipate, and they're trying to say, how do we keep this downtown? You know, we don't want to lose it. There's a lot of things pulling against that, you know, a lot of centrifugal forces pulling away from downtown. What can we do? And that's what Gruen was about. I mean, he institutes malls in other parts of the country, pedestrian malls. And in the end, they all, you know, come to the same conclusion that Kalamazoo did in the late 90s. It didn't work from the standpoint of businesses. And so you start reopening those streets.
Yeah, why didn't it work?
I think in the end, because parking was an issue. You know, you still had, especially when the Ring Road things, so now you got to park, and well, either you pay to park in a parking ramp, and a lot of people don't like to do that. And the other thing is, well, with the mall there, you don't drive by it and say, oh, hey, I'd like to stop there. You have to already be parked and walking the streets and say, that's an interesting store. I didn't know that store was here. I'd like to go in there.
When did the city let go of this plan, the parts that hadn't been built, which was most of it?
I don't know off the top of my head exactly how it died, but I think certainly by the early 60s, it's become clear. It becomes fairly clear early on that they're only going to get the Burdick Mall in. Of course, closing Michigan Avenue, as the plan proposed, would also have required cooperation with the state because that is a Michigan highway, M43. So, you know, even today, that is an issue as the city fathers, the city planners are looking at how do we revitalize downtown. You can't do it on your own. So you run into some political jurisdictional issues. You certainly run into people who are saying, I don't want to pay the taxes for this. You probably couldn't have got at the time commitments from some of the department stores, the national chains. I mean, Sears was already building its out of downtown store, which is now the City of Kalamazoo's Justice Center on Crosstown Parkway. That was originally a Sears store when they closed their business, which is the building now that known as the Haymarket Building. Probably the most visible store over there now is the Wine Loft restaurant, but that was a Sears store. They're moving out, and I suspect that you found the same thing from other stores saying, no, we can't commit to staying here. So you've got all of these factors. I would say somewhere, the mall opens in 59. Oh, it's been a while since I looked. But it opened 50, 59. And then I would say within a couple of years, it's become clear that, and then there are other issues. There, we didn't talk about other issues. There were concerns that the Ring Road would, in effect, segregate the city of Kalamazoo, and, or at least block it off. And it was perceived by many who lived in poorer neighborhoods, particularly people of color, that they would have been being cut off by the Ring Road, that it was kind of a barrier. And so you begin to get some opposition on as well on the grounds that, hey, it's you're making it difficult for the north side, the east side neighborhoods that were predominantly historically neighborhoods that had at least significant African-American population. So you've got some of that opposition as well, that this is like throwing up a physical barrier that says you're not welcome here.
I've heard people say, thank goodness this plan didn't go through. We didn't build this ring road around downtown. We didn't build these big parking lots and plan on having people walk into this series of pedestrian malls. Well, what would there have been to regret? Is there anything we missed out on by not going with the Gruen plan?
Well, that's always hard to say, because when you start debating what might have been, you bring your own perspective to it. I think that in some ways the entire plan might have made for a vital downtown in some ways. I also kind of tend to think that at the time it just sort of went against the spirit of the times. And you could have completed it and people still would have said, I want to go to a suburban mall. I want to build a house out in the suburbs. I want to get further and further away from the city. I don't want the traffic. I don't want the noise. And we have to keep in mind that at the time, there was still a lot of manufacturing going on in the city. In particular, the paper industry is still along the Portage Creek and the like. So you've got, I want to get away from all of that. I want to be able to. The ideal of a single family home with a nice big green lawn and a white picket fence is something that really inspired people. And now they're having just these new malls out there for us to shop at, and the highways, the interstate is making it quicker and easier to get to, not to pick on anybody, but easier to get to Matawan, easier to get, why not do that?
It's interesting, though, when you look at the plan, you don't only say, oh, my goodness, what on earth were they thinking about? This is a bad idea. This is too much, or this is just silly. You see some good in it.
I think that there was some good. I think part of the idea of making the downtown, the malls, not just because they would not have been just for retail. There was a lot of space for public interaction on there, places to sit and eat a lunch, eat a snack like people did along the mall and still do. That was all built in. There would have been this bringing people together aspect to it that would have been good. I think one of the negative things with it is that it also assumes this ongoing eternal love of private automobiles. And, you don't have to go too far reading today to find a lot of people saying those days are going to be ending, at least in big cities, and maybe even in a city the size of Kalamazoo.
It sounds as though the interest in having a vital downtown remains and is strong now, but the idea for the means for how that happens is very different from in the 50s.
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think what happened is that the downtown never fully collapsed, as it sadly did in other cities, but it is now revived, and it's not the retail center of the county, but there's a lot of entertainment. There still is a lot of commercial and office professional use downtown. The big hotel, several museums, the library, lots of restaurants. Downtown has recreated itself as a different sort of destination than the Gruen plan anticipated. The Gruen plan is still, I think, heavily anticipates that people are going to come and shop downtown. Today, you come downtown and there are plenty of places to shop, but they're specialty shops. They're something like, oh, this or that. But it's not a shopping destination per se. Once you get here, you can find there's a lot of shopping you can do. But the downtown it's a different downtown than Gruen envisioned, and probably envisioned for any of the cities where he was invited in to do some urban planning.
Tom Dietz, thank you for your time.
Oh, sure. And a lot of this, it's just my speculation, my own thoughts. But it's a topic worth pursuing.
All right. Well, thank you.
Okay.
Tom Dietz is a Kalamazoo historian and curator emeritus of the Kalamazoo Valley Museum. We spoke about the Gruen Plan of the 1950s, which would have greatly changed downtown Kalamazoo. The city approved it, but later changed its mind. I'm Sevilla Mann.
WMUK's Sevilla Mann interviewed Tom Dietz for that segment, which originally aired in June. It was also in June that Upjohn Institute Vice President and Senior Economist Kevin Hollenbeck sat down to discuss a new report, The Road Toward K-12 Excellence in Michigan. Kevin Hollenbeck, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Let me begin by reading from the introduction of the report. Michigan is a state in which education has been accorded high priority by policymakers, parents, businesses, educational watchdog organizations, the media, and others, yet student achievement has been stagnant over the last decade. How did that happen?
Well, I think mainly the problem has been the economic situation in Michigan. There was a national recession in the early 2000s. There was a bigger recession in the 2007-2009 timeframe. And sort of in between those recessions, Michigan really did not recover as much as other states because we had a lot of restructuring and reengineering going on in the automotive industry. And so we think a large share of the blame, if you want to use that word, goes to the economic picture in the state.
So is there money right now that Michigan could be spending on education that you have found they are spending somewhere else and therefore it could be reallocated?
Not really. We tried to shy away from making any specific recommendations about how the legislature would fund or how much they should fund education. We do think there should be some more funding. But it turns out that the Michigan economy is not at all strong. And in the report, we show that the growth rate in the economy over the last decade or so is 49th out of 51 states plus the District of Columbia. Our economy is not strong. Despite having a weak economy, we've done pretty well in funding education. The share of our economy that goes to K-12 education is above many states. We're in the middle of the pack or even a little bit above the middle of the pack in terms of share of funding going to education. So we have a problem. We believe that funding is crucial to improve education. We're in a situation where the economy is sort of just now recovering from deep recessions and there isn't a lot of funding out there. And so it's a problem that will take a long time to be resolved, I think.
I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent here, but when you say the economy is not strong, if Governor Snyder or a member of his administration were here, they would point out, X number of jobs created over the last few years. They'd point out that the state unemployment rate is now matching the national unemployment rate for the first time in 15 years. Is the state's economy getting stronger, and could that help alleviate part of the problem you've spelled out in this report?
Right. There's certainly all the evidence is pointing that the state is doing much better with its economy over the last few years. We are gaining jobs and reducing the unemployment rate. So yes, we think economic growth is a part of the answer to more funding for schools.
You also do point out, however, that Michigan has a problem in terms of the money spent on education actually getting to classroom instruction. What could the state do, or is there something they can do to guarantee that a higher percentage of that money spent on education is actually being spent in the classroom?
Right. We've made six major recommendations in our study. If the legislature, and we believe it should, find more resources for education, it doesn't make a lot of sense just to spend the money as it has been spent in the past. We're not getting the results that we would like. And so we're calling for targeting the spending through some demonstration projects that have been shown to work in other settings. So it's important that the spending does get directed to instruction. Michigan has a big problem with legacy costs. We don't really get into solving that issue, didn't really address that issue. I think that the state is sort of addressing that with some of their pension initiatives. But you're absolutely right, Gordon. We need to make sure that any additional resources that can be found get directed to instruction.
Should the state be focusing on at-risk students? Should they be focusing on students who have come from low-income families, perhaps low-income areas of the state? Is that a concern as well?
Absolutely. A big emphasis of the report is focusing on getting resources to low-income students. We found kind of this insidious effect that the more low-income students in a district, the worse results are for both low-income and non-low-income students. In our report, we've identified 7 exemplary states in terms of student achievement and in terms of helping low-income students. And to give you a sense of the comparison, Michigan currently has a funding source for low-income students called Section 31A categorical, and it works out to about $600 per student. 6 out of the 7 states that we looked at give additional funding for each low-income students on the order of $2,000 to $5,000 per student. So Michigan, relative to those states, is quite far behind in terms of funding low income. And we think that overall student achievement in the state will clearly need to include the low income students as well. Interestingly, it's the case that no state has really done a great job at decreasing the gap between low income and non-low income students. So we can't criticize Michigan for not reducing that gap. No state has really done it very well.
But have some states done it better than others?
But some states have done it a bit better than we have and still maintain much better test score results for everybody.
The last time that Michigan made a major change to how it funds schools was back in the 90s with something called Proposal A, approved by voters, which changed the funding mechanism in many ways. Is that part of the problem, as you see it right now, with where Michigan stands in terms of education and financing?
The impetus for our study, which was funded by 3 Michigan foundations, the Kellogg Foundation, the Steelcase Foundation, and the Skillman Foundation, the impetus was to look at the effect of Proposal A on student achievement. So that was sort of the whole goal of the project. Proposal A was not really an education proposal. It was really a property tax relief proposal. But it also had a very beneficial effect in terms of equalizing funding across districts in Michigan. During the 90s, funding got more equal across districts, and all districts were seeing increases in student achievement. The problem came along in the 2000s, when the economy started going bad and the state could not continue to increase the foundation grant as much as it had been earlier. And furthermore, Michigan was losing population and losing student enrollment. And Proposal A actually ends up hurting districts that decline in enrollment. The reason for that is that if you lose a student, you lose the entire foundation grant, but your costs really don't change very much. You still need the same number of classrooms, the same number of teachers, and so forth. And so
you have to lose a certain number of students before you can justify having one less teacher.
Exactly. Over the last few years, about 3/4 of Michigan's school districts have lost enrollment. So this is going on in the majority of school districts. So we think it's time to tweak Proposal A, alter Proposal A. I would say in this study, we looked at funding mechanisms in other states. And most states, when they went to a foundation grant system, have been using what they call categorical funding or special pots of funding in their budgets for flexibility purposes. What seems to be happening in Michigan is we went to a foundation grant system, but we also have been cutting back on categoricals. And so we really don't have a lot of flexibility in our funding system, despite the fact that the 500-plus traditional school districts and 200-plus charter school districts are different, have different needs, different student characteristics. And so the funding system just doesn't serve, it doesn't have a lot of flexibility in it.
You make a recommendation that there be an allowance for what are called local enhancement millages. If this were to be implemented, how would this work? Would voters in a school district have the chance to boost education funding on their own?
Yes. Since the state economy is limited, it's growing, but it's limited, we think a source of resources to bring into education would be local property wealth. And so we believe that one change to Proposal A would be to allow a limited local enhancement millage. We propose supplementing that millage for those locations that don't have the same property wealth as other locations. We also would like to somehow design this system so that the money gets spent on instruction, as we were talking about before. And we think that if a location would fund such a millage, we're suggesting 3 mills for up to 5 years, then the charter schools in that district, since they don't have a
school
community,
district elections,
per se, they don't rely on property taxes or can't, they would also receive the additional funding. Community passes this millage, it goes to the traditional and to the charter school districts in our proposal.
There currently is an allowance for an enhancement millage countywide or in an intermediate school district, which has been passed by KRESA in the KRESA area, for instance. Are you saying that that's not enough for schools to be able to enhance education and enhance their finances?
That's correct. Kalamazoo has been very fortunate and is obviously very supportive of its educational districts in passing that millage. That millage has not passed in most other intermediate school districts. The problem with that system, it does allow local enhancement, but the problem is that it requires the majority of all the voters in a fairly large region comprised of multiple districts with multiple different needs and interests, and it's hard to get conflicts resolved at the local level. So we think a local district millage would work better.
So as I noted, the report is called The Road Toward K-12 Excellence in Michigan. Does that indicate that it is something of a long journey? Is this a long-range thing where you look out on the horizon and say, we've got to be here in 10 years, here in 15, et cetera?
It absolutely is a long-range journey. There are no silver bullets. No legislator is going to come up with something today that's going to show an impact next year, in my humble opinion. So what I'm saying is we need to take this mindset for the long haul, that it's due to the recession and restructuring and so forth of the last decade that's hurt our students educationally. We want to be able to look the students in the face 10, 15, 20 years from now and say, you know, we've done all we can, and now you are competitive with all other states.
Kevin Hollenbeck, thank you for your time.
Sure. Thank you, Gordon.
Kevin Hollenbeck is Vice President and Senior Economist with the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo. He also was the lead economist on a report called The Road Toward K-12 Excellence in Education. That interview with Kevin Hollenbeck first aired in June. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.